Welcome to the Natural History Cupboard. Come on in.
And welcome back to the Natural History Cupboard podcast, the place where the weird and wonderful parts of the natural world come together. I'm your host, Gareth, and with me as always is my co-host, Aaron. Aaron, say hi.
I'm back.
You missed out on doing that a lot for last week, so you're making up for it this week.
Making up for this week. Affirmative.
Very good. Well, I know what you've been up to this week, Aaron. That doesn't sound stalkerish at all, because this week you were, well, with me, we were carrying out our live show, weren't we?
Yeah, we were. We did basically from spring to sea along the River Tor, the local river in the area. It was it went really well, and it was great. Thank you to the library for hosting us, and thank you to everyone who came along.
Well, I'm still incredibly shocked that we didn't have any major technical flaws. So, yeah.
And we did not, considering how often, like, we use
technology.
To be fair, you know, when we use cameras, is when we introduce cameras is where it goes wrong, right?
Yeah, but this the moment time, we're on film.
We were very clever this time. You see, we used one laptop to film us, a GoPro to film us, and a mobile phone to film us. And we had... there were people taking photos too. So we had all the bases covered just in case one camera got the curse of the cupboard.
And there was also a sketch artist in the corner who sketched every single second. Yeah. Piles, reams and reams of pictures of us. All terrible, but you know. Yeah, no, it went really well.
It was enjoyable.
It'll be a sign of more to come when it comes to live shows. So you never know. We might be coming to a town near you. Probably not for a while yet.
Getting people involved towards the end with the basking shark, that was cool. We had people hold up bits of a wooden cutout that Gareth did of a basking shark just to show people how big they can get.
Still didn't even fit in the room.
Yeah, we had to bend it around like this basking shark was going around like a rock face kind of thing because
more than 90 degree angle.
In the room. Huge. Yeah.
Well, yeah, so that went off relatively well without a hitch, I would say. So
the kids in the crowd were great, weren't they?
Yeah, no, they were not, they knew what they were talking about.
Kept chucking answers out to questions we'd asked. Brilliant.
Yeah. Right, well, should we head on into the news?
Let's do it.
Right, well, we're into this week's news. Aaron, take us away. I don't know why I struggled to say that then.
Every week, the weird and wonderful world of natural history offers up an embarrassment of riches when it comes to news and interesting stories. And though we here at the Natural History Cupboard are but a small team, it's our aim to keep you, our fellow cupboard dwellers, up to date on the good, the odd, and the exciting. So let's open up the Natural History Cupboard newsreel, where we've compiled some of the more interesting headlines, and dive on in. And I think I've got the first one this week.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes to us from fizz.org. In fact, all my articles come to fizz.org this week. It's not that I've been lazy, it's just that they were really interesting. Fizz.org tells us research team discovers more than 50 potentially new deep sea species in one of the most unexplored areas of the planet. An international team of researchers co-headed by the Centro Nacional de Supercomputación in Barcelona have found 160 species living on seamounts off the coast of Chile that were not previously thought to have existed in the region. 50 of these are in fact new to science.
Unfortunately, I'm going to bring the mood down very quickly, because what sounds like some sort of ridiculous anecdote or joke, unfortunately, is also a terrible thing that happened in Wyoming. And this is from the CowboyStateDaily.com. Wyoming man cited for capturing live wolf, reportedly showed it off in a bar before killing it. And this is the very sad news that a man reportedly captured a wolf whilst snowmobiling, running it down, taking it, instead of shooting it there and then and putting it out of its misery, He then took this particular wolf, taped its mouth shut, showed it off in a local bar before taking it out the back and shooting it. The man has been charged with possession of a live wolf. If you ask me, just the possession of a live wolf in itself is an insane thing, but the fact that they're saying it's illegal to kill wolves in this particular part of Wyoming is in my mind the least of the worries, because shooting a wolf is one thing, you know, killing it is one thing, even trapping it to kill it is one thing, but running it down with a snowmobile to tape its mouth shut to show it off in a bar before then, I would say gangland style, just shooting it out the back is horrific and shows a level of disrespect for not only animals, life and nature, but just shows what a low life piece of scum this particular person was. And I don't care who hears me say that. But the Wyoming Game and Fish Department verified that somebody had been cited for and fined for the possession of a live wolf, but didn't realize that the person, didn't release the person's name, the name of the investigation, or the game warden, or any of the details of the case. And personally, I'd like to think that they're going to try and charge him with animal cruelty, but yeah, it's really not a nice case at all. In any way, shape, or form. Yeah. Aaron, bring us back up.
Yeah, well, I predicted this would happen, if you remember. Last time I reported on... I didn't predict it, that's the wrong words, but last time I reported on changes to wolf protection in the US, thanks to a certain former president...
rich person.
That they were now legally allowed to kill animals in all manner of ways. And I actually listed running it down with a vehicle was illegal. Deliberately doing it to hunt it, running it down was illegal. I believe it was either a Ski-Doo or a quad bike that I mentioned, but a Ski-Doo is a snowmobile. That is just a slam. Absolutely disgusting and heartbreaking. Rotten pain. Not sure if this is going to bring the mood back up, unfortunately. But again, from fizz.org, iconic savannah mammals face genetic problems due to fences and roads, which kind of goes along with what I've been saying for a long time, that there isn't any wild places in Africa, not really anymore. It's one very big zoo because of all the fencing and that. Anyway, despite its ecological importance, the great migrations, like those of the wildebeest through the Serengeti and Masai Mara, are becoming fewer and further between across Africa as human infrastructure increasingly interrupts or obstructs the migration's progress. Roads, farms, urbanization, and fencing all play a part in preventing the migratory herds from roaming ancestral routes in search of water and grazing opportunities, and of course, breeding.
Well, I'm going to hopefully bring things back up from that. I mean, it can't get much lower than people beating wolves to death. This is from New Zealand, or RNZ, News Online. And that is compulsory microchipping and desexing of pet cats after the Lower Hutt Council vote. And this is the quite good news, I'd say, from a conservation point of view, that the Hutt City Council has voted to introduce a new keeping of cats section under its control of animals bylaw, which also makes it compulsory for cats over 12 weeks of age to be on the New Zealand Companion Animal Register. And this is in continued moves to try and limit the amount of cats basically roaming around a country where cats are not meant to be, but being done in a really well thought out and well planned manner. So last year, they basically voted through this particular part of a law, and it actually had 92% approval rate from people and public submissions that were opened up to it. Very good. If that doesn't tell you how people feel, you know, about protecting their wildlife and making sure that not only are these cats not breeding, you know, feral cats out of in places, but it also shows that people recognize the importance of obviously microchipping their pets as well, from just a genuine just making sure you have an idea of where your animal is, you know, if it goes missing. Yeah. So it basically is shown like a quite an increased thought process around that. Cats that can be exempt from desexing is if they are registered as a nationally recognized cat breeding organization, or if a vet has determined it would be harmful to the health. So it doesn't mean that there will be no cats, you know, allowed to breed in New Zealand. It's basically limiting it to specific problems. But your average moggy will undergo what's called the chipping and snipping rule, which I think is a good name to call it, to help cut the huge numbers of unwanted cats surrounding the animal, surrounding the area, and also inundating welfare groups, making it easier for owners to be reunited with lost pets. So there's very little to say in a bad way. Also stops the feral population of cats, which devastate native wildlife in New Zealand, and helps to get rid of that problem. So yeah, there's not really any bad news on that front. And I would love to see that sort of thing come in everywhere, to be honest.
Yeah, you know? That would be good. I wonder if there's any, because if you're a registered breeder of cats, then that is a huge burden of responsibility on you to make sure that your cats do not escape into the wild. So I'm just wondering if there are legal ramifications of some sort, like fines.
I imagine
if your
there
cats
would
get
be,
out.
Yeah.
I also wonder if there's the same for, if there's a going to be a ruling for if your cat cannot be desexed because of health issues, according to a vet, if there's then a mandate on you to keep your cat an indoor cat or a catio cat. And then, and again, if your cat escapes, there's some sort of fine or something.
There does seem
important.
To be more
I sound harsh, but
I think these are things that need to be taken into account. And I would say that they probably have. It would appear that New Zealand has very much the mentality for basically dealing with cats in a fair and sensible manner. And, you know, a 92% approval rating for something like that.
Yeah, that's really
often very unheard of for, like, you know, a law being brought in.
Well, in this country, for a law that protects wildlife over people's own self-interest, that would be unheard of in Britain.
Definitely. And yeah, congratulations to New Zealand on being far more forward-thinking than most places on the planet.
Moving on to my last article of the newsreel. Again, like I said, fizz.org. Researchers map 33 new big game migrations across American West. So sticking with migrations, after the last one I did, this time over in America, as the U.S. Geological Survey, in collaboration with the wildlife agencies of Arizona, California, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, Washington, Wind River Reservation, Wyoming, and for the first time, the states of Oregon, Colorado, and the Pueblo de Tesuk, I'm not sure how to pronounce that one, in New Mexico, have documented in map form no less than 182 unique herd migrations across the Western United States in a new volume called Ungulate Migrations of the Western United States, Volume 4.
It was never my favorite one, that one. I preferred Volume 3. Far better tracks on it.
Well, 33 of those 182 are new. So
good. New compilations. That's what you're gonna
love. Yeah. not just the nostalgia hits.
Yeah, no, yeah. But you've got to have some of the greatest hits in there, you know. Buffalo Soldier. I can't think of any other sort of ungulate related songs now. Anyway, moving on. My final article is from the Scottish Wildlife Trust, and it's the sad news, I'm bringing us back down again, that the first death of a red squirrel from squirrel pox virus has been confirmed north of Scotland's central belt. So they're sad to basically point out that this first death of a red squirrel has happened on the outskirts of Dunfermline in Fife. And this news could be serious for the red squirrel population in Scotland, which in itself is in a bad state anyway. But Scotland is very much a haven for the red squirrel. But squirrel pox, if you're unaware, is spread by the grey squirrel, which is an introduced species into the UK and needs to be eradicated, I would say, because it spreads this rather nasty virus. The news, like I say, could have serious consequences for the populations, and they are urging people living in the region to take photos of and report any sightings of sick or dead red squirrels. And that can be through the squirrels at scottishwildlifetrust.org.uk. You could also go through their Facebook or Twitter as well. They have that. And record these and all of the sightings via their website. Take in all wildlife feeders from gardens and woodlands for the next month or so. Carefully and thoroughly clean them with an antiviral solution such as Vercon, to kill off any potential. That sounds really harsh to take in and get rid of all of the possible food, but if you're in that area, this virus spreads through contact of urine or liquid or, you know, any sort of leftover fomites from another squirrel. So by taking away their food, it stops the possibility of these animals congregating and possibly passing it on. So think COVID, basically, in how we all acted during that. Just for squirrels, but far worse for them than I think COVID was for humans. So yeah, it is one of those ones that needs to be stopped effectively. And you can be part of that solution if you're in Dunfermline or in Fife. You can basically help by reporting those squirrels and cleaning up areas where you know squirrels go to, if you're lucky enough to have red squirrels coming into your garden.
And not to jump off too much on that, because these are the headlines, we're supposed to rattle through them quickly, but just in case we do have any new listeners, when we say about eradicating grey squirrels in the UK, it's because they are an invasive species that was introduced here, allowed to run free, and it has very much displaced and nearly wiped out our native red squirrels, which serve an ecological purpose here. Anyway, that just about wraps it up for this week's rather sad installment of the Natural History Covered Newsreel. We do try and
go rather long with the headlines, and also rather sad on them, I suppose.
Yeah, we do try and keep it light, and we next week will be a return to form.
Sometimes, though, it almost needs it. But
yeah, yes. Definitely.
Anyway, sorry, continue.
Now, remember, if you guys at home have news articles or topics of interest that you think we should cover, send them on in. You can use any of the usual ways to contact us, whether by email, social media, or pigeon, smoke signals, didgeridoos, any method. And you might just see your chosen article covered here or in our natural history news discussion. And with that said, the main topic this week is Australia battles to save last 11 wild earless dragons. It turns out that this minuscule grassland dragon is approaching the precipice of oblivion a lot quicker than anyone could predict. A worrying population survey in Canberra, Australia, has recorded just 11 earless dragons this year, where 5 years ago they found them in their hundreds. This is particularly concerning as the species hasn't been found outside of Canberra in over 30 years. The species is represented by 3 critically endangered subspecies and 1 endangered species. They are light brown in colour and measure less than 15 centimetres in length and are named for their lack of external ear openings. Researchers are fearing an end to the species within the next 20 years, and with only 11 left, it's hard not to think that they're actually being a bit optimistic. They're currently threatened by climate change, habitat loss, and the presence of invasive flora and fauna across Australia, such as cats. But there is reason to have hope. There are multiple breeding programs across Australia, including one such program set in a biosecure facility to ensure the absolute best protection for the genetic reservoir being built up. These are particularly difficult reptiles to breed, as females are both highly territorial and understandably picky over who they mate with. This means scientists must play more active roles in matchmaking, introducing males one by one until a female approves. And this is, of course, after they have ascertained whether the male or female are, in fact, a genetic match in order to keep the bloodlines healthy. On top of this, work has to be done to safeguard their habitats across the Earless Dragon Range to ensure that there is a home for the species to go back to. So, despite the fact that this is very worrying, I think the main thing to take away from this is that there are captive breeding programs in place to try and boost and support this species, whilst also making sure that the genetic health of the species remains viable, which is obviously quite difficult to do when they are so picky and territorial. But it's and very
help things.
Very good news that there is this genetic reservoir. I can't remember how many numbers they had, but apparently it's going pretty well.
Well, I mean, that's good to know. They're a pretty little species, and yet again another Australian species that's under threat from a variety of different.
Well, it's the two headline grabbers, isn't it? It's the increased amount of wildfires in Australia with climate change and all that, and it's the introduction of invasive species displacing native species. So I'm thinking things
cats
like
probably being the cats, single most
foxes
detrimental animal in Australia.
Yeah.
Now, sad to see in a lot of ways, but good to see in others.
Well, next week, good news.
Yes, definitely. shall we swiftly move on from talking bad news into a creature feature, which I think it mixes the good with the bad, but is also, I think, utterly fascinating.
Yes, I think we should.
Is hoping.
Swiftly float on over.
Hmm. So this week, Aaron, we're going to be looking at some birds of prey. And we've looked at birds of prey before quite a bit on the podcast. Everything from the hen harrier, the wedge-tailed eagle, the red kite, and the harst eagle as well. Well, this particular week, we're going to be looking at a species that is like no other when it comes to talking about birds of prey. This one is shaped by its environment. I mean, all species are. Its intelligence is second to none in the bird of prey world, and that's the caracara. Now, this particular bird rivals parrots and crows with a very earned reputation for being highly intelligent. And that is not saying much when you look at most of the birds of prey, because they're usually thought of as being less mentally sophisticated, since they specialize in hunting and are essentially driven by the same sort of drive to catch food that, say, a cat is. They don't need to think too much about it. Not saying that birds of prey are thick, because a lot of them are quite intelligent. But when we tend to think of intelligent birds, birds of prey don't tend to feature in most people's lists. It's usually crows, other members of the corvid family, as well as parrots. Well, this bird, the striated caracara, it certainly deserves to be on the list of intelligent birds. So what is a caracara? Apart from sounding like a fun word to say, these are birds of prey that are in the family of Falconidae, which is the falcons. They've been traditionally placed in their own little group with the forest falcons, which are a particularly nice-looking, kestrel-like birds from Southern America. And that's Polyborinae. Now, the caracaras are principally found in South and Central America, with some of them reaching just into the very southern bits of the US. There are 10 species of caracara. There were 11, but the Guadalupe Caracara is now extinct. So it's just the 10. However, there has been quite a bit of argument over who is related to who for a very long time. As with all species, there's always someone who wants to have their name on a piece of paper to say, no, it's 9, no, it's 10, no, it's something else. But there is 10 recognized species at the moment. Their body plan is similar to most falcons, with the striated caracara being 53 to 65 centimeters long, with a wingspan of roughly 116 to 125 centimeters. To give you an idea of sort of their standing height, I mean, just saying numbers doesn't really put it into context. If you think of them about the same size as a Harris hawk, maybe a little bit stockier than a Harris hawk. And they can weigh anywhere up to 1.2 kilos. Now, the sexes are identical. It's very hard to tell them apart. Basically, their plumage is almost identical, with a brownish-black body with white or tawny streaks on their upper neck and back and a bit onto their breast. This is where the striated bit comes into their name, because it means striations, little lines. And they're very, very pretty little feathers that are on their neck and their back. So their tail is quite wide, like in a lot of birds that need to be able to hover or work close to the ground. They use it for stopping and stabilizing themselves. And when we talk about where they live in a minute, you'll realize it's a very, very windy place. So it's got a white tip on the very outer edge of it. And their underwing and thighs are sort of rusty brown to a rufous red color. Really pretty, stunning colors that are quite muted compared to a lot of other birds. And you could quite easily just pass this bird by and not look at it, because it looks dark or brown with little bits of white on it. But the more you look at it, the prettier they get, I think. And they've got bare skin patches around their face. And in youngsters, it's a salmon pink color on their face, around their eyes and onto their beaks, the edge of their beak slightly. When they get older, it goes a lovely yellowish orange around their face. And it pretty much tells you whether it's a juvenile or whether it's an adult based on that color. Their irises are brown, and their legs and feet are also this lovely orangey yellow color. The best way to sort of picture it is imagine a really strong egg yolk color, you know, that really sort of standout bright yellow. And it's quite noticeable. So juveniles as well, until they reach their adult plumage, when they still will have that bare pink color on their skin around their face. Before they reach that plumage color, the juveniles are black to brownish black with just a chestnut tail and quite a lot of gray on them as well. Now they gradually attain their adult plumage over about 5 years. So it takes a little bit of time for these birds to reach maturity with their colors on their feathers, but even longer to then gain the coloring on their face. As you know, I like to look at the etymology of where these animals come from. And the word caracara, apart from just being fun to say, it actually comes from, well, it appears to come from the Tupi language, and it refers to their guttural rattling call that apparently sounds like the running of a stick along a fence. Well, we'll insert a caracara call here. So there's their call, quite a loud call, to be honest. I've heard these guys calling. I've worked with them presently and in the past. And yeah, their call is quite distinctive and loud, and you'd know what it is if you were around where these birds are. Their scientific name, Phalacobinus australis, comes from the Greek. And Aaron, do you want to take a guess at where it comes from? It's got two halves to it. The Phalacobinus bit.
I'm just trying to think what that might be.
I think the first half is probably the easiest bit to guess.
Yeah, Is phallocopinus, does it begin with PH?
It does begin with PH, but you would pronounce it as an F.
Yeah, my mind's gone blank.
Well, I'll put you out of your misery.
Yeah, no, please.
The phallocone bit means hawk or falcon in Greek.
Right.
Yeah. And the bayano bit means I go, I walk. Which I think
well,
brilliant.
I wouldn't have gotten that one, but yeah.
I had no idea until I started looking into that. And Australis means southern. Mm. So it's the southern walking falcon, which is quite apt for these birds. Because
yeah,
they actually spend an awful lot of time on the ground. They are not hunters in the traditional sense, as most birds of prey. They spend an awful lot of time walking on the ground. Where will you find these birds? Well, do you know where they come from, Aaron?
I know that they come from like pretty much as far south in South America as you can get, like the very tip.
Yeah, pretty much. The striated caracara is found, I mean, the caracaras, like I say, are found right the way throughout South America. But the striated caracara, my personal favorite, is found on the Falkland Islands and Isla Grande and Tierra del Fuego as well, in Isla de los Estados, which is Staten Island, Isla Navarino, Cape Horn itself, and other islands around the far south of Argentina and Chile. So they're right at that very, very tip of South America and out onto the Falkland Islands. It was, unfortunately, hunted to extinction on the East Falkland Island. These guys are found primarily on the rocky coasts and tussock grasslands, but also into inland mountain foothills, and generally they're non-migratory. But they will live pretty much anywhere and everywhere over the Falklands. They're not a massive place, and it means that the birds can easily traverse from one area to another. They're known to seasonally head to higher elevations, and the Falklands are a very, very rocky, open terrain. They're very, very windy terrain as well. If you think of these very windswept islands at the very bottom of the world, they are about as barren and inhospitable in some ways as you can get, although it's somewhere I've always wanted to go to. And they will quite happily, like I say, move to higher elevations. They've also been found to be occasional winter visitors to some of the other South American islands around this region, and then moving from island to island to find food in little gangs. Now, one of the big things that makes this bird special is its diet. Think of birds of prey. We tend to think of their diets being usually just meat, basically, you know, mice or rats or other birds or things like fish eagles, obviously taking fish. But striated caracaras don't care. They will eat anything and everything. They're what are known as opportunistic feeders. And they will eat everything from carrion, seabirds, marine mammals, invertebrates, stolen eggs, livestock, food scraps, human waste. They have been known to pretty much eat anything that they'll quite happily come across. Now, some of the recorded prey species have included penguins, adults, and chicks. And this is where they seem to get their other name, the Johnny Rook, which is thought to be sort of a derivation of the Johnny penguin, which is the Gentoo penguin.
The Gentoo, yeah.
So basically predating on Gentoo penguins, which visit the islands as well, and they'll quite happily eat adult and juvenile. Brown skua, which that is an impressive thing for it to take on, because skuas are not small birds in themselves. They're also not a bird to be pushed around. They'll quite happily fight back. So the fact that they take their eggs as well as their chicks, it shows how good these birds are at attaining food. Seal pups, including the South American fur seal, the southern elephant seal. They're also known for taking a bird which I had no idea even existed until looking into this, the blackish synclodes, which is a small finch that lives right on the Falkland Islands, just found it in and around that part of South America. So they can even catch small finch-like birds. They'll eat shellfish and the eggs from nesting seabirds as well. Cormorants and penguins alike. Most predation of larger species is usually done in small groups. And this is where a lot of the juvenile birds will mob together. Basically, imagine a band of teenage birds hanging out together to try and mob and get food, because they will often be kicked off like a nice easy kill by larger adult individuals or pairs. So a mated pair will just kick them out of that area. This, unfortunately, has led to them being seen as a pest, and we'll cover that a little bit as we go on when it comes to livestock. Invertebrates also make up a giant part of their diet, and it's quite impressive because they'll quite happily go for all the different invertebrates that you get if you lift up rotting seaweed on the beach, larvae of different beetles that you'll find in and around the undergrowth. They've also been known to quite happily go and take mussels and limpets, sandworms, and dig up earthworms as well from various different people's gardens and from beaches. They're also known for predating on young lambs, which, like I say, has led to a persecution of these by sheep farmers. And before 1999, when a law forbidding the killing of the species were introduced, they were seen as fair game. But I'll explain a bit more about that in a minute. Striated caracaras are also quite happy when it comes to kicking others off their own food. They are not picky. Their diet plays, or the diet of these birds plays a large part as what makes them so successful, because they'll eat anything and they'll go anywhere to find it. But after fledging, the juveniles will form large groups, like I said, and mob food. They find it a lot easier. This increases their chances of surviving by finding food. If there's more birds looking out for a dead seal on the beach, there's more chances they can all mob in and get something to eat, and they'll survive their first few winters. The times when juvenile mortality is at the highest is during the middle of winter. So banding together as a group of juveniles really helps to keep them obviously alive and healthier. It offers also better defense against aggressive adults that will kick them out of their own territories. But their intellect is what allows these guys to thrive so well. They will quite happily find whatever they can, wherever they can, and make the best out of it. So compared to other brainy birds, as we tend to think of them, falcons often test quite low on intelligence scales. But these birds are incredibly intelligent and have adapted to a variety of different things. Obviously, that humans have put in place, bins, as well as farm equipment, you know, finding food around that. And they basically make the best of what they can. So much so that researchers have really enjoyed going and testing these birds. And there was quite a big study done where they took a variety of different puzzles for these birds to have a go at. Now, these puzzles themselves were actually designed for parrots, and they were used and tested with Goffin's cockatoos, which are, well, like most cockatoos, quite intelligent. So these tests were conducted with a transparent plexiglass box that was sort of octagonally shaped, had varieties of different puzzles on either side of it, and there was obviously a food reward. It's the easiest way to get most things to interact with any sort of thing like that. So they got a bit of meat if they were able to solve it. To access the treat, the bird had to do things to obviously lift or open or get through, you know, the various different parts of the box. Some of them were slides, some of them were cups, some of them were chains, some of them were even like paper windows that they had to sort of push through to get to the food, or even pull a wire. And they tested 15 caracaras by putting this box out there in front of them, just out in the wild, that had no prior training to this puzzle box. All of them solved at least one puzzle, and 10 of the birds successfully completed all 8 tasks. They also got faster at solving the puzzles every time they did it and repeated the experiment. One bird, after practicing, was able to complete all of the challenges within about 5 minutes. Some of the caracaras worked out the solutions to the more difficult tasks, which less than half of the cockatoos figured out during repeated tests, it was claimed. So they're more intelligent than those particular cockatoos. These birds were so curious about the puzzle box, the researchers had to keep them away while others were completing the task. So you end up with these groups of caracaras turning up, all mobbing around a potential food source, whilst the researchers are just trying to get one or two of them to carry out the task, which definitely hints at their curiosity. The fact that these guys see something and they go straight for it because they know there's a potential food source there, which is worth messing around with, essentially. Some even started running towards the box as soon as they set it down on the ground after a couple of times of seeing others doing this. So, easy food reward. And this intelligence seems to have evolved as an adaptation to their really harsh habitat. You've got to find food where it is at that point, because if you don't, you're not going to survive. And you've got to be able to think and outthink those other birds that might be potentially getting to that food before you. This is where we get to the point where we talk about the interaction with people and also these birds, because obviously people do live on the Falkland Islands. They're a British territory, and there's a lot of sheep farming. You know, it's basically something we seem to have done, gone around the world and gone, yeah, need some sheep. And because of that, these birds come into conflict with humans. One of the real first paintings and descriptions of a caracara, a striated caracara, was done by George Forster in 1775 on James Cook's second voyage to the Pacific Ocean. So that was one of the first ones. In the 1830s, Charles Darwin, on his circumnavigation of the globe on the Beagle, noted that the caracaras that he encountered on the Falklands had a penchant for stealing the crew's belongings, including a black hat and a compass. So, although that sounds to me like somebody sort of left those things out and, you know, lost them that way. It's also said as well, and this is, I believe, partly sort of folklore, but also works quite nicely with how intelligent these birds are, that anything that's the color red attracts them. Sort of the whole red rag to a bull. Well, think of more red rag to a caracara. They're not going to get aggressive, but the thought is that they see something red and they associate meat or blood or, you know, some a dead animal, basically. So they go and investigate. Although, personally, I think they're more intelligent than that, and their vision is also incredibly good. So I think red just stands out more, so they're more likely to go and investigate, not necessarily because it's a food item, but more so because something that stands out could be a food item, not because red equals food. Red just stands out, I think. So that's definitely true. Certainly with the ones that we worked with, we had to, during one of the falconry shows, warn people, if you have anything red on you that's a potential thing for them to steal, you need to put it away now, otherwise they will steal it. And he did at one point. Yeah, that was a particularly nice caracara that we had called Johnny. Obviously not very creative with the name, I know. But unfortunately, due to this curiosity and their lack of fear towards humans, they, a lot of the time, think of these guys in the same vein as herring gulls, you know, using that intellect and that curiosity to find food, which is almost identical in some ways, has led them to being seen as a pest by farmers. And they're known to target newborn lambs or weaker ewes. And unfortunately, from listening to some of the descriptions of farmers who've had caracaras attack their livestock, they're not particularly nice about it. Bit of a trigger warning, I suppose, for what I'm about to say next, is that they tend to mob the ewes or a lamb, and they tend to go for the eyes or the tongue or around the anogenital area and sort of open them up and leave the animal not in a very nice state.
Right.
Farmer then has to come along and put them down. Now, obviously, this is horrendous because we don't want to see an animal suffering. However, they are doing what they do best, which is find food, find the easiest food, and disable it as quickly as possible. So, yeah, it's that real... I can see the irritation and I can see the pain that it would obviously cause to a farmer.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we can't really blame the birds for doing what they do so well, effectively. In 1908, they were designated officially a pest species and a bounty was actually put on their heads by the Falkland Island government. And the farmers were paid for every beak, which I find an odd one. That's not one you tend to come across. Usually it'd be something like, I don't know, every bird, but every beak that was handed in. And in just 17 years, it was completely eliminated from East and West Falkland. In the 1920s, however, the government and the naturalist James E. Hamilton objected to the killing of the birds, and the bounties were stopped in 1930. They did not receive protection, however, for another 34 years in 1964. The current population is limited to approximately 1,000 to 2,499 mature individuals, which equates to roughly 1,500 to 3,749 individuals altogether. And this was a survey done in 2006 to basically count their population. They also found that the population was stable at around 500 pairs. And at present, the striated caracara is not considered to be facing any serious threats at the moment. The striated caracara, though, is officially protected by the Falkland Islands government by law, which makes it illegal to kill the birds without express written permission from the government to be able to do so. So it's somewhat similar to a lot of species that obviously can interfere with livestock. There can be exceptions given. And like I say, I can kind of understand with some of these, but still, the birds suffered a huge setback. They're listed as vulnerable and on CITES Appendix 2 as well, which means that they are essentially looked after and people are keeping an eye on their numbers to make sure that they don't drop. The biggest threat they probably face at the moment is climate change or any sort of change in the habitat. But even then, they're sitting kind of pretty in that they're very adaptable birds and they're able to find food wherever they go. And I'm surprised that the striated caracara doesn't have a bigger range because of that, but it's probably because it clashes with other members of the caracaras. And so they're an utterly fascinating bird. Like I say, I work with one currently in the moment and he's absolutely lovely. Jess also works with him as well, and she's was incredibly happy to be able to get a hold of this species to have where we are, and both myself and her have been working to try and get as much enrichment with this bird, and to be able to make sure that it has so much to keep its mind ticking over. They are essentially avian primates, which I know that kind of does down how intelligent birds are in themselves, but that's a lot of the way for people to understand how intelligent these birds are, is that they are like primates in their need for enrichment and for things to keep their mind ticking over, and lots of different ways for them to just find out what's going on. And even just simple things. I go into his aviary and I'll turn my phone on to a picture of a bird, or I had a phone call, a video phone call with someone whilst I was in the aviary. He wanted to come and sit and watch what was going on, to see what was happening on the screen, because they know what's going, you know, they can see a person there, they can hear a person there. And yeah, the level of intellect is really quite amazing. Utterly, utterly amazing bird, and one that I can't believe I haven't got to by this point, but we're slowly ticking off the sort of wildlife around the Southern Hemisphere. In fact, looking over your shoulder, Aaron, where you've got your background, which is our 2022 roster, we've got the snowy sheathbill as well, which is a bird that calls the Falkland Islands home on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the leopard seal, which we've just recently done, another one that also visits the Falkland Islands. Yep. So we've also got the Wara as well that Drew did, which was the Falkland Islands wolf. And that's without correct. The Falkland Islands wolf, these guys are pretty much the top predator on these small rocky outcrops in the South Atlantic. So, yeah.
They're an incredible bird. I've always admired them.
Hmm. Well, shall we leave these small rocky outcrops and head inland, shall we, to our emails for this week?
Yeah, let's do it.
Bing! You've got mail.
Ooh, it's an email. Right, well, we're into this week's emails. We're going to start off with our question from last week, which was to do with our fantastic Deodon, the hell pig, the Terminator pig, and every Terminator reference that was flying around yours and my heads at that particular point, Aaron. So that question was, what is your favorite extinct mammal? And we got some good responses on this one. Ones that I would say feature highly on the extinct mammal list. So Lindsay Kinsella put Megatherium. I mean, why not? Because they're a fantastic looking creature. Nick Tenick has put Thylacoleo carnifex, also very, very cool. I would love to see a snapshot in time of one of these hunting. Wouldn't everyone? I think there are many biologists and paleontologists that would love to know exactly how those guys hunted.
Yeah.
Sam Stockdale has put the dodo and woolly mammoth. I mean, that's good for the woolly mammoth. Unfortunately, dodo, not a mammal, but still cool anyway. Spencer Seams has put the giant Arctic camels. I'm assuming he's referring to the North American ones that used to tower over what would be a modern day camel. Steve Eddy has put the Bramble K. Malomies. Aaron, were you aware of what these are?
What? Sorry, repeat that.
The Bramble K. Malomies.
No, I was not familiar. I'm not.
It's a recently extinct species of mouse, essentially.
Okay.
They're quite cool, from Bramble K. Kelsey Watts, your brother, has put Welsh dragons, quagga, or dodos, but probably quagga. Fair enough.
That's, do you know what? I wouldn't have expected quagga from him.
Quagga's quite a cool one. And
quagga is a cool one, yeah.
Bar the Bramble K. Malomies and the giant camels, quagga we have not covered as a species.
No, the I next like one, that answer. It's a good answer.
We also haven't covered, I can't believe. Matt Jack Dupe said Parasitherium, a genus. Parasitherium, the genus. Or Silviaretherium genus. And they're two really awesome prehistoric mammals. Silviaretherium, the relatives of modern-day giraffe, look a bit like a combination between a giraffe and a moose.
Mm.
Zara Jackson's put the thylacine. Perfect. No notes. Jen Babs has put Ambulocetus. I love this transitional species. And in its own right, Hyracotherium. Wish that when
Hyracotherium.
Hyracotherium, yeah. Hyracotherium. Wish that when teaching horse evolution, we challenge students who assumed it was useless because it wasn't a species that looked like a horse. On that theme, since reading Rebecca Ragg's Rebecca Ragg Sykes' work, I have a real appreciation for them and the challenge when people assume, like the Hyracotherium, that they were useless. Evolution is not in high speed. And that's quite true. I personally, I'd love to see more horses with little hoofed tapir feet. I mean, that's why tapirs are more of my favorite than an actual horse. Same with rhinos. Tom Gray has put a rogue comment, but dinosaurs simply do not do it for me. It's all about the Pleistocene slash early Holocene animals. I think the mammoths, for their untimely extinction, has had the effect that ecosystems are still feeling today.
Absolutely.
Biological uniqueness, though, I'd have to say the giant ground sloths or Australian diprotodonts. So hard to choose. And yeah, those are quite true, actually. I mean, we don't really tend to think about just how much animals like the mammoth might have, yeah, the ecosystem might still be healing from their fairly recent loss. Stuart Beard has said, it's got to be the saber-toothed cats for me. And I think that's probably where you'd agree with him there, Aaron.
I think they are close second. I actually went with woolly mammoths, if you remember.
To be honest, I
extend woolly mammoth to pretty much any of the prehistoric elephant species.
Very true.
Yeah, saber-toothed like cats are
in that sense as well.
Smilodon fatalis and Homotherium and yeah, awesome animals. Mm.
And the final comment comes from my other half. She's put the unicorn. Now, I know she's being silly, but there is a species that is referred to as the Siberian unicorn, and that's Elasmotherium, the giant rhino-looking creature that wasn't a rhino. So I know that's not what you meant, but I thought I'd just put that one in there as well.
There's unicorns around today in, is it the Sahela? I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right.
The Sahela.
Sahela, yeah.
Yeah, but they're not horse. This is a body positivity thing. Real unicorns have curves. They're just called rhinos.
Yeah, and that is related to a horse.
Exactly.
So yeah,
far better. Sahelas are cool though.
Except for you can only go for certain types of rhino because other rhinos have, obviously they have, some of them have two.
Oh, well, my favorite is the Indian rhino and the white rhino are my two favorites.
Well, you get away with it, I suppose. The Indian one.
They are cool. Yeah. Right. So that was last week's question. This week's question to do with the Karakara.
I believe this week's question is, what is the best bird from your country and why?
Exactly. So I thought tying this in neatly to the Karakara, if you're in the Falkland Islands, I have a feeling that might be one of your favourite birds. I don't know. Can't speak for Falkland Islanders. But, you know, let us know what your favourite bird from your country is. Now, I would say that migratory birds also count as well. If they spend a certain amount of time there, I think that certainly counts. Aaron, what is your quintessentially, and I'm going to say English bird, and then I think we should open it out as Welsh, Scottish, Irish, you know, like, or do you want to just go with a British bird?
Well, for strictly British birds, I find it hard to beat the red kite in just its beauty and how cool it is. Even closely behind a red kite would be something like an osprey or a white-tailed seagull, but even they aren't really quite as cool as the red kite, in at least in how it looks. I love the way ospreys hunt.
Very cool.
For migratory, I would have to go with house martins. I look forward to them nesting back in the eaves of my house every year. I really do love
definite
seeing them.
Definite symbol of spring, yeah.
I love coming out every day on my way to work and I see them. For visitors, it's that random lammergeier vulture that every now and then one kind of glides over from the Pyrenees for the day. I love them. And the European bee eater, if for no other reason other than how stunning they are, and the fact that David Silver at Creative Beast Studios based the coloration of his Linharaptor on it, and it looks awesome.
Yeah, this is true.
That with all the feathers and the colors on it, looks far more terrifying than the raptors in Jurassic Park.
This is, well, yeah, yeah.
And I like Jurassic Park, and I like the raptors in it.
It's different. It's more terrifying for different reasons. Like, what on earth has happened to that poor animal? So, yeah. My choices, do you know what? I could almost pick just birds of prey, I think, that symbolize each country in my mind. Scotland, you could quite happily have the golden eagle, because let's face it, it's the only place in the UK where you'll find them.
Yeah.
The red kite, I tend to think of them and Gigryn Farm in Wales as such an iconic thing.
Mm.
Although you could almost say for England as well, because you go down the M4 corridor, that sort of part, they're just everywhere.
Yeah, you see them more than buzzards around there.
It's like insane.
I've seen a few around here over recent months.
Yeah, they're becoming far more common, in which case I would change that one to being the English raptor. And then I would I'd have the osprey for Wales, being the Dovey Osprey project and the Dovey Estuary being like home to quite a few pairs of ospreys. And those unfortunate ones that suffered at the hands of idiots a couple of years ago up in North Wales, where they cut down their nest.
Drew covered one for us, didn't he?
Yeah, those are three really iconic raptors. But if you had to pick non-iconic or non-raptor birds, it's the capercaillie for me. These are all like falling into the same thing. The capercaillie for me in Scotland, the black grouse in Wales, and in England, it's got to go, I think, in my book at least, to either the puffin or the oyster catcher.
Oh, puffin's a good one.
Mm.
I mean, there's
too
they're
many
all, they're all
very
good.
Iconic birds.
I do like puffins.
And I almost think Britain needs to have something very similar. If every country needs to have something very similar to, if you remember, New Zealand's Bird of the Century competition that they always do, where the Puteki Teki won it.
Yeah.
With no small thanks to John Oliver and Last Week Tonight for that one. Mm. But I think every country needs to be a bird of the planet, you know. Everyone should vote for the bird of the planet. Well, that'll probably go to something like, I don't know, a robin. Robins are nice, but they're a bit too common for me.
I like robins, but bird of the planet. I'd go cassowary.
Cassowary all the way. Exactly. Well, if you, dear listener, want to let us know what your favorite bird from your country is, your most iconic bird, put it on our Facebook page, where they go up every week, and we've got different bits coming in and out all the time. And you can also get in contact with us via our email address, which is thenathistorycupboard@gmail.com. The other way is, or the other way is through our social media, where we're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. But if you want to go the next step, like some of these wonderful people have, you can join our fantastic Patreon. Aaron, tell us about our Patreons.
Well, I know it's a week late now, but I am going to honor our Patreons and the hell pig Deadon in one fell swoop. So this week we would like to thank Jealousy McGee, Ronnie P, Jen Greenhall, Fogtober, and Nick to Nick. I'll be back.
Oink. Well, there you go. Get to the chopper.
Go now.
Got to throw that in there. Anyway, you can do so by joining our Patreons. We don't have a chopper. But money isn't everything, and you can also support us in a variety of other ways. One of them is just by listening, telling a friend, telling an enemy, telling a caracara very loudly. In fact, yeah, if we get caracaras right, because they mob together in a little group, they might all like increase the listenership, you know, bird passing it to bird, passing it to bird.
Hmm.
So they might destroy any sort of phone or listening device you give them. So, yeah. Swings and roundabouts. You can also like, comment, and subscribe on whatever podcasting service you're listening to us on. Leave a comment, a like, whatever. That helps immensely.
Mm-hmm.
You can also join our Patreons, like those wonderful people have. You can also buy the merch on our fantastic T-Mill store. And also a big thank you to all of the people who came along to our wonderful live show the other day, which went off without a hitch. We didn't have any technical problems, which I was expecting. I think that went rather well, don't you, Aaron?
Yeah, it was enjoyable, yeah. And thank you to the people that came, and thank you to the library.
Yeah, so hopefully we'll be doing more of those. So that will be coming out initially on our for our Patreons, but then later on in the year, I think we'll have it as a bit of a bonus episode, I suppose, something to put on towards Christmas, something like that, maybe.
Yeah.
But I don't think it went too badly. Recording-wise, did it, Aaron? You've listened back?
I've listened, kind of skim-watched the footage and the audio back for the first show. And yeah, it went really well. The second show, I might have a look at tonight and let you know, because
blend the best of them together.
Yeah.
But that pretty much brings us to the end of this week's episode. So big thank you for coming along, Aaron.
Yeah, I mean, thank you. And thank our listeners as per usual. And again, thank you to the wonderful people who I mentioned there who support us via Patreon. Your help really does help us and help this podcast improve. And yeah, again, just thank you to the library and the people that came along to listen and the people that helped us.
Definitely. And a big thank you to you at home for listening. And we'll see you next time here in the Natural History Cupboard. Bye.
Got to go. Be back next Sunday.
One does not simply like the color red. One must be obsessed with the color red.